So my name's Matt Welker, as I was introduced, and work for the American Institute of Architects, which is a membership organization representing about 83,000 architects and built environment professionals. It's beyond impressive to me to be here and to hear so many public health experts and planners and this diverse panel working together and talking about these issues in a way that's really meaningful to people who are responsible for shaping for the actual design and construction of the built environment, the way we intersect it. Looking at that as one sort of example of an opportunity for collaboration, there are others, and I'm going to walk through those, as well as a conversation around the need for a new vocabulary, a new way of communicating with each other and understanding. So first I'm going to go through sort of what the unique role of an architect is, sort of as a primer to this conversation, what their unique needs are, and where there are opportunities to really drive health through the way we practice and maintain our licensure. The second is I'm going to talk about programs and collaborations that architects are currently engaged in as a ground that works in a collaborative space and where there are opportunities to change that, to grow that. And finally, about the efforts to establish an ongoing and meaningful common vocabulary that's accessible to cross-disciplinary groups and speaks to them in a way that they understand, whether it's visually or otherwise. So I'm going to start with the hard part, which is architects. We are a confusing group of people. We are vast and we are sprawling, and there is a joke that the difference between God and an architect is that God doesn't think he's an architect. conveniently, I heard the same joke made about public healthers last night. But it's great, and I think that part of it is that we have this long history as a licensed profession. We, in our sort of accreditation process and a licensure process, are required to obtain a NAB-certified degree, which is usually a Master's of Architecture at a minimum, complete 5,600 hours through an internship development program, and then complete 7 exams. And that's just to get your initial license. And then once you get your license, you get to repeat that in other states, and you can look for reciprocity. And then you have to maintain it with mandatory continuing education hours, which vary by state and by jurisdiction. So you practice in more states, you accrue more hours. And it gets messy. We spend a lot of time thinking about how are we going to hit our requirements for health, safety, and welfare. The AIA requires its members annually to complete 12 hours at a minimum of health, safety, and welfare credit. And it's an opportunity to change that definition and to move that forward and start embedding health in the education we deliver to architects. And I think looking at some of the education opportunities that are available on the Clearinghouse site is a good place to start. In terms of the architecture profession, health, safety, and welfare relates to the structural integrity or soundness and health impacts of a building. So it's a sort of narrow definition as it exists right now. And it consumes us. But in addition to all of that, architects wear a lot of hats. This is a picture of architects wearing hats of buildings. The expectation, though, is that beyond maintaining our licensure and beyond being able to design buildings, we're called upon to be a responsible voice for budget, to keep projects on track, and to navigate red tape associated with policy and to interpret the policies that are set forth at the community scale and those upstream things as we materially manifest the agenda of a client, the agenda of a community and of a people, and to really drive forward whatever that desire is. We work through a smorgasbord of constraints. One of the most influential architects in my decision to become in this field is Joshua Prince Ramos, who made the illustration up at the top. And he talks about architectural success as a manifestation that slides seamlessly through the project's and client's constraints. It's inherently about solutions to often complex problems, which range across these issues, right? You have project requirements at the beginning of the scale, it's the minimums that are required, and you balance it all the way up to the sort of aspirational scale and voluntary-based systems and certifications like the STAR community system, like LEED, like Living Building Challenge, things that are traditionally based in environmental ecology and in energy performance. Increasingly, we're seeing those shift to health, but along the way, you're balancing codes and regulation and standards that affect every profession in the built environment, every individual, whatever scale they're working at, differently and at different times. And it gets really tricky and really messy. There are two things I want to add to this, and the first is that more often than not, these minimums are designed to prevent inefficient procurement and performance. Buildings that meet companies that sufficiently navigate this at a base level are fine. They won't fall down, most likely, hopefully. But they're not driving us forward or to a healthier population, a healthier nation, a goal that everybody here believes in and shares. And the second thing is that these are all in a continuum. The regulatory codes that are designed to affect transportation planning and policy, if we embed health in that policy, we then look at how that affects the community scale and how that affects siting decisions, and then how that affects all of the things that we consider as we design buildings and manifest agenda. Sort of working in reverse then, talking about scale, which begins at the individual and then moves to materials and the systems in terms of the role architects and other built environment professionals have. So what HVAC systems are we using? How are we incorporating eliminating known carcinogens in the building? How are we incorporating windows and thermal systems that really maximize air circulation, improve air quality? And then as you move into a building scale, how do you incorporate stairs and active design that continues the principles of active living that we see at the site and community scale as we sort of build out and flesh out our communities that we live in? As we look at that, I think we're making a lot of progress, but I think in terms of collaboration, one thing I think about constantly is how do we operate from our greatest strengths? And I heard this yesterday in another session. It was talking about public health individuals at an academic university engaging recreation programs and professionals, and that the recreation program had bounced around from a couple of departments. It was trying to find a home and shared goals, but recognizing strengths and sort of working through that. I like this policy from the AIA Directory of Public Policies and Position Statements. It was adopted in 2011, which is a messy and tricky process. But it says that architects must advocate for responsible design that results in beautiful and healthy places that respect and accommodate society's diverse cultures and needs. What I like about it is that I think we all agree that we need beautiful and healthy spaces that respect and accommodate society's diverse cultures and needs. But I like that it leads with beautiful, because architects thrive when they're dealing with aesthetics and when they're inspiring people, when they're inspiring us to make the healthy decisions that we are trying to get at in the way we structure our policies, the way we plan our communities, the way we think about health. Looking at that then, talking about briefly programs and collaborations that exist, Boris Lushniak presented to a group of architects and public health professionals in April at a summit that we hosted. It was one of the many pit stops he's made to built environment professionals, and although I think we really can hone in on the idea that we have this partnership, one thing I want to touch on quickly is how catalyzing his presence was, that America's top doc, or acting top doc, would walk into the den of architects and deputize us, that he would do it to APA and ULI, the Urban Land Institute, and developers, that he would show up at Greenbuild here a couple of weeks ago and deliver that same message, is unprecedented in the world of architects. And it validated built environment individuals, I think, to really own these ideas in their practice. And now they're stepping forward and they're saying, I'm interested. What do I do? And how do I talk about it? So as a structure that we use when we're talking about architects and trying to simplify concepts at a really basic level, we talk about six things. Environmental quality, which we think of as the sciencey side of issues. Natural systems, which we think of as trees and access to nature and biophilic mimicry. Physical activity. Safety, which goes beyond the definition of safety that's embedded in health, safety, and welfare and includes things that we know so well through especially planning. Around like crime prevention through environmental design, things that are well documented, but talking about that as a way to improve physical health as well as prevent from psychological harm. Sensory environments, the sort of squishy components, which are really fun to measure and really speak to architects' desire to inspire and to create beautiful manifestations of our health goals. And finally, social connectedness, which is our proxy for social capital, which we found was a turnoff word for architects. When we said social capital, they got confused, and they sort of shut down. And we had these incredible round discussions with public health experts and anthropologists and talking to people about how to identify this. And they're like, the word is social capital. But for architects, it's not. So the other thing is that there are three mechanisms that architects are using to drive this forward and to actually practice it. And they're looking at policy, community-based interventions, and then research. Within policy, We're looking to streamline, to carry the idea of health and all policies through our codes and zoning processes, and looking to create tools and collaborate on tools that can be used to advocate for these at a local level where most policies that immediately affect architects exist. Within the community's engagement, there's a cohort of architects working in D.C. specifically, who are really interested in bringing together, bringing in public health individuals, bringing in health experts, and having them issue design briefs, either real or hypothetical, and to talk through the issue, and then in real time, over the course of a few hours, work through those ideas visually so architects can embrace and interpret those ideas and those concepts and those issues in a visual way that speaks to the way we think and work. And then finally, research. Working with the Association of Collegiate Schools of Architecture and the Association of Schools and Programs of Public Health, AIA and the AIA Foundation issued an RFQ for teams that purposefully embed plant or built environment experts and health experts on research teams to improve the utility and validity, a term I kindly have appropriated from Chris, to improve that research base and really drive it toward practice. But in order for any of those to be successful, and this is sort of where I'm going with this, and in order for any of those to be successful, we need a common vocabulary, which is sort of visible here. It's a report we produce, and it's really pretty. Anyway, the idea that we need a common vocabulary is doubly important, I think, when we start thinking about that continuum of practice, when we see evaluation tools coming onto the market that are affecting and going to guide architectural practice and planners and everybody else. We need similar language so we can communicate with each other and ask smart questions. But we also need to do some expectation setting, I think, through vocabulary. When we talk about morbidity and mortality, what does the built environment expert hear? And what's more, how do they start to visualize responses to that? I think we go back to this place of visual effects. The two plus sides in this sort of strategy toward a common vocabulary is that through the built environment and public health clearinghouse, we've already accumulated 1,500 plus words. A lot of words, like a lot of words with really great definitions that are accepted, drawing largely on planning and transportation and health, really meaningful words. It should be a go-to resource, right? There's no reason when we looked out in the landscape and started talking about vocabulary, the AI side, we were like, why bother trying to accumulate words when the built environment and public health clearinghouse is doing such a great job? So we jumped in, right? The question is, how do we increase the utility of this for architects and built environment professionals and the public? How do we drive them there? So the second thing is that I believe there's a way to reinterpret it. I believe that there's a way to engage people who think visually and the public to make this more meaningful. So we reproduced at that April meeting I talked about the entire glossary from Making Healthy Places by Dannenberg, Frumkin, and Jackson on a 45-foot poster, basically. It was enormous and exhausting, and there were only 3 known typos. And then we had sticky notes. There was room to write on this, right? To take a marker and say, I don't like this word. This doesn't make sense to me. Or what does this maybe feel like? We had sticky notes that you could add a word or edit a word, contribute an idea, or just make a comment, right? I don't understand what this means. Why is this relevant? It doesn't resonate with me. And what we found is that architects were really eager to engage, but so were the policymakers we had present, so were the health experts we had present, so were the academics. In asking them to sort of break it down by profession and self-identify something, and there was some overlap, they could have multiple things, most people were unknown, in part a design flaw in the tool, but there was this really strong group of designers, and it was an equal population in terms of how the summit was attended. People were interested in engaging, and they were interested in adding words. One of the things we found when adding words, though, is that oftentimes they were adding very similar words, and it was remarkable, I think, because it then spurred edits to those words, and people were editing each other's contributions, And I think that that's an important sort of takeaway as we think about the glossary and how it lives and how it interacts and how we can make it a more vibrant, living sort of document. But in this visual format, they felt more comfortable having a way to interpret and understand words, to drive towards shared ideas. And sometimes it was, you know, community, sometimes it was place, sometimes it was spaces, right? Those are three sort of words that neighborhood, like they start to get at similar ideas, but they also get at different ideas. And sometimes when we start talking about those, I think we can lose ourselves a little bit. And when we recognize that they're related, they're similar, and that they maybe have a shared sort of visual representation, I think it's a way we can start driving these ideas forward and enhancing collaboration and opportunities. So going forward, we are going to be putting out a call, really, to architects and trying to engage them and visual thinkers to interpret, to visualize the words that are included in the glossary, to expand that. And maybe it doesn't look blue, and maybe it's not full of AIA honors and awards photos like we did at the summit. Maybe it's not, you know, sticky notes and manual, but making it this more engaging, more vibrant visual place to really spur and catalyze the change, especially in programs like the ones I spoke about and also the one Anna's about to speak about.